Chapter 22. My experiences as an author began early in 1867. I came to New York from San Francisco in the first month of that year, and presently Charles H. Webb, whom I had known in San Francisco as a reporter on the Bulletin and afterwards editor of the Californian, suggested that I publish a volume of sketches. I was charmed and excited by the suggestion and quite willing to try it if some industrious person would save me the trouble of gathering the sketches together. I didn't want to do it myself, for from the beginning there has been an empty spot in me where industry ought to be. Webb undertook to assemble the sketches. He performed this office, then handed the result to me, and I went to his publisher's, Carlton's establishment, with it. I approached a clerk, and he bent eagerly over the counter to inquire into my needs. But when he found that I had come to sell a book and not to buy one, his temperature fell 60 degrees. I asked the privilege of a word with Mr. Carlton, and was coldly informed that he was in his private office. But after a while I got by the clerk and entered the Holy of Holies. Ah, now I remember how I managed it. Webb had made an appointment for me with Carlton. Carlton rose and said in not a very inviting manner, "Well, what can I do for you?" I reminded him that I was there by appointment to offer him my book for publication. He began to swell and went on swelling and swelling and swelling until he had reached the size of a god of about the second or third degree. Then the fountains of his great deep were broken up, and for 2 or 3 minutes I couldn't see him for the rain. It was words, only words. But they fell so thickly that they darkened the atmosphere. Finally, he made an important sweep of his right hand, which took in the whole room, and said, "Books, look around you. Every place are books that are waiting for publication. Do I want any more? Excuse me, I don't. Good morning." 21 years went by before I saw Carlton again. I was then staying with my family in Lucerne. He called on me, shook hands in a friendly way, and said, "I am really an unimportant person, but I have a couple of such major distinctions to my credit that I am entitled to immortality. I refused a book of yours, and for this I stand without competition as the prize fool of the 19th century." It was a most handsome thing for him to apologize, and I told him so, and said it was sweet to me because during the past 21 years I had in fancy taken his life several times every year, and always in new and increasingly cruel inhuman ways. But now I should hold him my true and valued friend, and never kill him again. I reported my adventure to Webb, and he bravely said that not all the Carltons in the world should defeat that book. He would publish it himself on a 10% royalty. And so he did. He brought it out in blue and gold and made a very pretty little book of it. I think he named it The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and Other Sketches. Price, $1.25. In June, I sailed in the Quaker City excursion. I returned in November and found a letter from the American Publishing Company of Hartford offering me 5% royalty on a book which would tell the adventures of the excursion. Instead of the royalty, I was offered the choice of $10,000 cash upon delivery of my story. I consulted A.D. Richardson, and he said, "Take the royalty." I followed his advice and closed the deal. I was out of money, and I went down to Washington to see if I could earn enough there to keep me in bread and butter while I wrote the book. I came across William Swinton, brother of the historian, and together we invented a scheme. We became the fathers and originators of what is a common feature in the newspaper world now, the syndicate. We became the old, original, first newspaper syndicate in the world. It was on a small scale, but that is usual with untried new enterprises. We had 12 journals on our list. They were all weeklies, unknown and poor and scattered far away in settlements. It was a proud thing for those little newspapers to have a Washington correspondent, and a fortunate thing for us that they felt in that way about it. Each of the 12 took 2 letters a week from us at $1 per letter. Each of us wrote 1 letter per week and sent off 12 copies of it to the journals, thus getting $24 a week to live on, which was all we needed in our cheap and humble quarters. Swinton was one of the dearest and loveliest human beings I have ever known, and we led a charmed existence together in unlimited contentment. Swinton was a gentleman by nature and upbringing. He was highly educated, he was of a beautiful spirit, he was pure in heart and speech. He was a Scotsman and a Presbyterian of the old and real school, being honest and true to his religion, and loving it and finding peace in it. He hadn't a vice. Unless a large and grateful sympathy with Scotch whiskey might be called by that name. I didn't regard it as a vice because he was a Scotsman. Scotch whiskey, to a Scotsman, is as innocent as milk to the rest of the human race. In Swinton's case, it was a virtue, but an expensive one. $24 a week would really have been riches to us if we hadn't had to support that bottle. Because of the bottle, any lateness in the arrival of any part of our income was sure to cause some inconvenience. I remember a time when a shortage occurred. We had to have $3, and we had to have it before the close of the day. I don't know how we happened to want all that money at one time. I only know we had to have it. Swinton told me to go out and find it, and he said he would go out and see what he could do. He didn't seem to have any doubt that he would succeed, but I knew that was his religion working on him. I hadn't the same confidence. I hadn't any idea where to turn to raise all that money, and I said so. I think he was ashamed of me privately because of my weak faith. He told me to give myself no uneasiness, no concern, and said in a simple, confident, and unquestioning way, "The Lord will provide." I saw that he fully believed that the Lord would provide, but it seemed to me that if he had had my experience, but never mind that. Before he was done with me, his strong faith had had its influence, and I went forth from the place almost convinced that the Lord really would provide. I wandered around the streets for an hour trying to think up some way to get that money, but nothing suggested itself. At last, I walked into the Ebbett Hotel and sat down. Presently, a dog came over to me. He paused, glanced up at me, and said with his eyes, "Are you friendly?" I answered with my eyes that I was. He waved his tail happily and came forward and rested his head on my knee and lifted his brown eyes to my face in a loving way. He was a charming creature, as beautiful as a girl, and he was all made of silken velvet. I stroked his smooth brown head, and we were a pair of lovers right away. Pretty soon, Brigadier General Miles, the hero of the land, came walking by in his blue and gold uniform, with everybody's admiring gaze upon him. He saw the dog and stopped. There was a light in his eye which showed that he had a warm place in his heart for dogs like this gracious creature. Then he came forward and patted the dog and said, "He is very fine. He is a wonder. Would you sell him?" I was greatly moved. It seemed a marvelous thing to me the way Swinton's faith had worked out. I said, "Yes." The general said, "What do you ask for him?" $3. The general was obviously surprised. He said, $3? Only $3? Why, that dog is a most uncommon dog. He can't possibly be worth less than 50. If he were mine, I wouldn't take 100 for him. I'm afraid you are not aware of his value. Reconsider your price if you like. I don't wish to wrong you." But if he had known me, he would have known that I was no more capable of wronging him than he was of wronging me. I replied, "No, $3. That is his price."
"Very well, since you insist upon it," said the general.
And he gave me $3 and led the dog away and disappeared upstairs. In about 10 minutes, a gentle-faced, middle-aged gentleman came along and began looking around here and there and under tables and everywhere, and I said to him, "Is it a dog you're looking for?" His face had been sad before and troubled, but it lit up gladly now, and he answered, "Yes, have you seen him?" "Yes," I said. "He was here a minute ago, and I saw him follow a gentleman away. I think I could find him for you if you'd like me to try." I have seldom seen a person look so grateful. He said that he would like me to try. I said that I would do it with great pleasure, but that as it might take a little time, I hoped he would not mind paying me something for my trouble. He said he would do it most gladly, repeating that phrase, "most gladly," and asked how much. I said, $3. He looked surprised and said, "Dear me, it is nothing. I will pay you 10 quite willingly." But I said, "No, 3 is the price." And I started for the stairs without waiting for any further argument. For Swinton had said that that was the amount the Lord would provide, and it seemed to me that it would be wrong to take a penny more than was promised. I got the number of the general's room from the office clerk, and when I reached the room, I found the general there petting his dog and quite happy. I said, "I'm sorry, but I have to take the dog again." He seemed very much surprised and said,
"Take him again? Why, he is my dog. You sold him to me and at your own price."
"Yes," I said, "it's true, but I have to have him because the man wants him again."
"What man?"
"The man that owns him. He wasn't my dog." General looked even more surprised than before, and for a moment he couldn't seem to find his voice. Then he said,
"Do you mean to tell me that you were selling another man's dog and knew it?"
"Yes, I knew it wasn't my dog."
"Then why did you sell him?"
I said, "Well, that is a curious question to ask. I sold him because you wanted him. You offered to buy the dog, you can't deny that. I was not anxious to sell him. I had not even thought of selling him, but it seemed to me that..." He broke me off in the middle and said,
"It is the most extraordinary thing I have ever heard of. The idea of your selling a dog that didn't belong to you."
I broke him off there and said, "You said yourself that the dog was probably worth $100. I only asked you for 3. Was there anything unfair about that? You offered to pay more. You know you did. I only asked you for 3. You can't deny it."
Oh, what in the world has that got to do with it? The truth of the matter is that you don't own the dog. Can't you see that? You seem to think that there's nothing wrong with selling property that isn't yours, provided you sell it cheap. Now then, I said, please don't argue with me any more about it. You can't get around the fact that the price was perfectly fair, perfectly reasonable, considering that I didn't own the dog. And so arguing about it is only a waste of words. I have to ask him back again because the man wants him. Don't you see that I haven't any choice in the matter? Put yourself in my place. Suppose you had sold a dog that didn't belong to you. Suppose you...
Oh, he said, don't mix me up any more with your crazy reasonings. Take him along and give him a rest. So I paid back the $3 and led the dog downstairs and passed him over to his owner and collected $3 for my trouble. I went away then with a good conscience because I had acted honorably. I never could have used the $3 that I had sold the dog for because it was not rightly my own. But the $3 I got for returning him to his rightful owner was rightly and properly mine because I had earned it. That man might never have gotten that dog back at all if it hadn't been for me. My principles have remained to this day what they were then. I was always honest. I know I can never be otherwise. It is, as I said in the beginning, I was never able to persuade myself to use money which I had acquired in questionable ways. Now then, that is the tale. Some of it is true.